let's just start with discussing formalities, because we're having, I hope, fantastic course this semester, and maybe you can share like your thoughts and ideas of how to analyze foreign policy and maybe what you've learned from the course so far.
Really, do you think I learned something?
I think you did. Yeah. Well,
I think I hope some, you know, students learn something, or rather that they are critical. I think foreign policy analysis is something that is obviously important. I think at the same time, it doesn't give us any real solutions, or at times rather muddies the waters and makes it actually even more difficult to understand a certain thing that seems to be very clear-cut, right? I mean, if we start with just a typical media discourse or speeches of Western politicians, phrases such as the unprovoked and full-scale invasion of Ukraine is something that, you know, seems to be pretty clear-cut. So it's the Russians that are to blame, and it's Ukraine defending itself. And of course, if, you know, if you put it in those dichotomous way, that's maybe the closest you come to reality. But of course, things are a little bit more complex also over the, you know, course of almost 3 years that the war has been dragging on. So, I mean, when it comes to foreign policy analysis, I think it's interesting to see that there are now so many different approaches that you see a trend that you find, I guess, everywhere in academia, that in order to actually fill a position or for, you know, professors to market themselves, that they come up with all kinds of, you know, fancy terms and kinds of schools that they created. And the latest handbook of foreign policy analysis, from which I took some chapters for the readings, I think has more than 35 chapters on kind of different approaches. So, I mean, what I think is interesting is that there is a substrand of foreign policy analysis, be it metaphor analysis or narrative analysis or, you know, things on so-called ontological security. I mean, these are all, I think, at times just buzzwords, but I think the essence is that the way how we think about states, about nations, about collective identities actually matters, and there is a lot of historical continuity in if you invoke certain terms, for instance, certain metaphors, certain self-understandings, and I think that shapes foreign policy. So the key thing that I learned, at least, and hopefully others as well, is that there are at times, you could call it narratives or analogies or you know, national role conceptions, that's another term, that are simply irreconcilable either within a state, so that you have some tensions that also create why there are sometimes drastic changes in foreign policies, as well as frictions or tensions between states. Because, I mean, the understanding of the respective position in the world or so-called national interests also diverges. So I'd say that's the the key point from what I learned so far.
Yeah, but for me it's a very interesting topic, because I mean, as you might know, I've always been, I mean, at least like recent 3 or 4 years, I've been dissatisfied with theories that you can find in the mainstream academia, whether it's you know, structuralism. I mean, all those theories, like realist.
You mean mainstream IR theories? Something like realism, liberalism, constructivism.
Which are the theories that are the most important for policymakers, right? Whenever you go to any sort of policymaking body, I mean, people mostly operate with those theories in mind, right? That's what also most, I mean, Americans learn in the academia, and those are, I mean, by far the most, you know, cited, the most cited work, so to speak. And from this, for example, from this, I mean, I would say just from this dissatisfaction, you know, I came to explore different theories. I mean, mainly from social theories, right? That I found it's so and found such a rich way of understanding, so to speak, foreign policy and foreign policy analysis that, I mean, I, for example, think it can really enrich understanding, and then, of course, it can enrich policymaking in the future. And, like, surprisingly, if you think about international relations, not as a science, but as a way of, like, really trying to understand another perspective, which from, you know, my conception of international relations, this is probably what international relations should look like as a discipline. Because you really want to understand deeply, I mean, another person's perspective. And this is diplomacy, so, like, it should be about that. However, again, if you go to mainstream theories, what you find is, like, most of this idea of, you know, universal values and ideas that, of course, American, like, predominantly American academia presents as something that is indisputably scientific, universal, I mean, what have you. And I think this, out of this tension, it's interesting to, like, from my perspective, it's just interesting to see how this tension actually plays out in the world affairs today, because from my reading of, you know, again, the conflict in Ukraine, it's just basically simple misunderstanding. I mean, both sides just struggle to understand each other, actually. And I mean, more so Americans, I think, than Russians, but Russians as well. I mean, I think, you know, at least the official narrative that, you know, the US is also imperial power, and all of this is also a little bit misleading in a way. So it's definitely, I think, a very interesting to see how foreign policy analysis will develop in the future, and, you know, what type of impact they're going to have on...
What do you think it should actually contribute to? Because, I mean, I just thought when you were talking that maybe this, I guess the study already has been done, because there is now comparative literature on how international relations is taught in other countries, especially India, China, Iran, you know, maybe Brazil. But I mean, I would be curious also to learn which kind of literature, or if there are theoretical approaches, are actually taught at, you know, diplomatic, you know, training programs. And the same goes for journalists, I think. So, I mean, I guess one of the reasons why we still seem to be stuck in that time warp, if you will, or that, you know, there hasn't been that much change apparently since the 1970s, is that if you look at media coverage and foreign policy speeches, a lot of that still uses those categories that you are referring to, you know, of typical realist thinking, liberal thinking, and also the kind of buzzwords are there, right? So, I mean, it would be interdependence in the terms of liberalism. It would be something like values and norms in a social constructivist language. And I think, of course, constructivism brought some progress, because it focused researchers also to look at sort of the intersubjective understanding of things. I mean, is what, when we talk about freedom, do we actually mean the same thing? So I think one got a little bit closer to reality or different perceptions and the problems that might result from that. But as such, I think we are still not very far, or haven't gone that far. So, I mean, it's still at times very, disappointing kind of development that, I mean, what is, and the way that foreign policy is then analyzed is often simply by, you know, pulling all of those old categories from the drawer and then just saying, okay, I mean, from a realist perspective, country A behaves this way because country B did that. So, I mean, it's at times surprising how simplistic things are presented.
Yeah, certainly. I think it should definitely try. I mean, it try to enrich your understanding of the world and, of course, of another countries and another society, so to speak. That should be, like, I would say, definitely the goal of any, you know, discipline of international relations. And I mean, I want to highlight the fact that it is a discipline about relations. So, you know, it should definitely bring some insights from psychology, from sociology, from other disciplines.
I think it does. I mean, if you look at those different approaches, it does. But for me, there are two crucial elements. One is there anything like a normative framework that we have should apply? I mean, so is there anything that if we think about foreign policy analysis, that there should be some kind of overarching, you know, global principles? Or, I mean, of course, these were envisaged with, you know, those who drafted UN Charter and things like that. But I mean, is there if we understand the motivations of the respective other, I mean, that's one thing. So, I mean, that would be sort of the desired aim of foreign policy analysis. But then the question is, where do we go from there? And I mean, one would be, is there something like a consensus on, you know, that, for instance, conflicts should be resolved peacefully, at least rhetorically? I think that's what most countries would subscribe to. But as we see, it sometimes works, it sometimes doesn't. And then the question is just, I would argue, maybe a more modest one, and that's just trying to reduce tensions as best as one can. And of course, that necessitates that you understand the perspective of other countries. But then again, I think there are a number of critics who also say foreign policy analysis is still so state-centric. And I mean, there are so many other things that you don't fully grasp when you only look at states that, I mean, we can have foreign policy analysis, but we should also have additional kind of analytic approaches. Studying the actions of multinational corporations, or also, you know, listening to, the people who may actually not be represented by the respective state. I mean, take certain national minorities, for instance, or religious minorities. So the disenfranchised, the certain groups that are oppressed. So, I mean, of course, it's all way more complex. But I think when it comes to a first attempt, it certainly makes sense to start with states first. And I mean, there, I think the picture has become ever more complicated because we simply see an increase in the number of states altogether.
Yes, and of course, I think as an overarching goal, it should definitely be, I mean, the achievement of peace. I mean, this, of course, no one would dispute that, in the sense of like, what do you really want to achieve from international relations as a discipline, to try to kind of construct the peaceful world order or the peaceful system? And of course, now we have a lot of conflicts in the world, right, and a lot of things going into the directions maybe opposite in the future, back in the day we thought that the problem of peace was largely solved, especially in relation to big powers, so to speak. And now, of course, we have kind of like a setback in this direction when you have basically something like very similar to pre-World War period of time, when, you know, you have just increasing amount of tensions. You also see the dynamic that just bad from all perspective, because it's really hard to understand how you can solve this conflict, because both parties really pulling into different directions, so to speak. And then on top of course, you have all the regional conflicts. And of course, just how to go about preserving peace, this would be also like the part of foreign policy analysis. Because of course, like, for example, with, you know, deterrence and NATO, and this is like one answer to this question, right? You need to increase deterrence, you need to kind of push, like, I mean, you need to kind of have like this perspective. But this is just one perspective, right? Even though it's a, like, one may say hegemonic one in elite circles, at least. But of course, And of course, if we talk about modern system, the most important question would be how to preserve peace in Europe. and how to maybe establish it now. I mean, of course, if you think about conflict in Ukraine as a like fundamental peace problem, European peace problem.
Well, I think that's something we often discussed. First of all, you mentioned deterrence, and I think that brings us into a debate that is very different from foreign policy, or it sometimes is intention. Because, I mean, this entire strategic studies debate is often one that focuses more or less exclusively on the military and defense. Equilibria, troop sizes, whereas I think foreign policy as such is a little bit broader and also has aspects such as confidence and security building measures, for instance, something that was also thought about in the CSCE, which later became the OSCE. So I think as such one should distinguish the two, like the strategic decision from foreign policy as such. I think I would like to go back to something you wanted to talk about, security in Europe, and I will come to that in a second. But what I find interesting is that the perceptions really seem to be, maybe not surprisingly, very Eurocentric, in the sense that I haven't really checked whether the number of conflicts as such increased at least dramatically over the last years. But what I see is that there was this very strange, I would almost call it Western European thinking, that the war in Ukraine is the first real large-scale territorial war since 1945. And of course, we discussed that already. This must sound terribly cynical for anyone living in the Balkans. But I mean, if we just look around the world, there are so many conflicts that are still ongoing or are still at least not ones that have ended, such as the war in Yemen, a lot of, you know, the civil war in Sudan, war in the Sahel zone. I mean, there is so much stuff where we actually don't have, I mean, if you look at the West, we talk about two conflicts, and that's Israel-Gaza, and that's the Ukraine war. And I mean, that's more or less it.
I mean, recently I mean, of course, if you think from statistical perspective, I mean, majority of wars throughout, like, I mean, at least around 500-year history, they happened mainly in Europe or involving European powers. So as such, most wars happen, unfortunately, either in Europe or involving, so to speak, European powers, which, I mean, another kind of interesting maybe topic to discuss in terms of what is wrong with you know, European powers, that, you know, they cannot actually coexist together for a longer period of time. But of course, like, from my perspective, just European perspective, it's of course like a biased perspective, but it is nevertheless important, because I mean, coming to foreign policy analysis, if you think about goal, I mean, of course, you, in the end goal, you just want to have like a peaceful, I mean, ecosystem in Europe, which you definitely have in Western Europe, or you definitely have in NATO members, right? But of course, I mean, for example, from my argument, the goal would be to extend this system further, right? To extend it to Russia and like to Ukraine, to Belarus, and what have you, into other countries that would, I mean, people in those countries would benefit from that. Because of course you want to have, again, this ecosystem, right? So to speak, a system where people can benefit from it. And this is, for example, from how I think about, you know, foreign policy analysis. And of course it should be goal oriented, because it is a policy, right? As such, it is designed to achieve something.
But I think it always has this tension. I mean, it has this tension of being supposedly scientific, and that's, in that sense, neutral or objective. Yeah. I mean, as best as it can, at least. And then, of course, if foreign policy analysis is some kind of guidance, like in the national security strategy of Germany, Olaf Scholz, who wrote the foreword, actually writes about a compass, you know, that basically allows you to navigate the world, right? I mean, if foreign policy is about that, I mean, it has at least has to reflect upon that, whether, you know, it can be technically hijacked for some ulterior motives of, you know, or generally some kind of may anti-democratic motives of actors. That's, I mean, although unclear, it needs that kind of degree of self-reflexivity. But I mean, I think what you just alluded to is also that foreign policy could do, in some strands do, I mean, think about certain aspects in a, or ideas in a hypothetic way. You know, there are things about counterfactual reasoning, for instance. There's also some stuff on, you know, academic foresight and the ideas of, you know, how things could play out. I mean, it's kind of scenario-based planning. And I mean, if we take your suggestion, just without the historical and political baggage, that of course makes it highly unlikely, to say the least, mm-hmm. to outright morally, you know, unthinkable to conceive of a European security architecture with Russia and Ukraine. One thing I think that foreign policy analysis would have to ask himself is, if that were to be successful, would it still mean that there is some kind of other, that, you know, this European security architecture would be directed against? I mean, would it technically just be a zero-sum game that by including Russia and Belarus, the entire Euro-Atlantic security sphere would be larger? Mm-hmm. But would it technically then be also a confrontation of one way or the other vis-a-vis China, for instance?
I mean,
I don't have a final opinion on that, but I mean, it's just that I think what hasn't been done, and I think in the literature on US-Russia relations and NATO enlargement, and also the things that you studied and the sources you consulted, mm-hmm. it seems to me that there has never been a very strategic thinking about, you know, the consequences, or at least that was not the mainstream. I mean, most thought of it like one step at a time. And when they then faced, for instance, some kind of resistance or opposition by the Russians, they thought how to, you know, mitigate mm-hmm. the, I call it in quotation marks, problem of NATO enlargement. Just one example. But I mean, I think that happens frequently that, I mean, for instance, if you take of Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, I mean, the idea was, there are human rights violations taking place. Muammar Gaddafi is a terrible dictator. I think most people can agree on all of that so far. And there is a revolution going on. And then, you know, even more ability to protect, which was justified as a way to actually use fighter jets and then bomb the... I think, yeah, if you look at Libya or Iraq or Afghanistan, I think there were a series of policy decisions where either some lofty, unrealistic goal was presented and people didn't think about any kind of contingency plans. And as such, my point would be that, at least to me, it seemed as if decision makers were only thinking, you know, one step at a time and maybe with a time frame of 2 to 5 years. And I think it's also important to have that. But I mean, if you do foreign policy analysis, or if you use foreign policy analysis as some kind of analytical tool to come up with a foreign policy for a respective country, then I think it should have such a strategic depth that it actually covers a longer time period, and that you actually define what are the kind of aims or targets that we have and how can we achieve them, and not, I mean, simplistically saying, well, we want to get rid of this regime or the other, but I mean, you certainly have to have an idea of what should come afterwards. And I mean, what could go wrong? And mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is plenty of empirical evidence that these are things that weren't thought through, and things were then made on the fly and things turned out terribly.
Yeah, that's true. And also in a way, how I think about the future of foreign policy analysis, I think a lot has been done in academia to demonstrate how maybe the US is wrong. Or, you know, there is a lot of compelling literature, a lot of compelling evidence to, you know, demonstrate.
What do you mean by wrong? Wrong in the sense of their assessments, which would be something in a certain thing, or in a normative sense?
Compelling criticism of American actions.
Based on the grounds that it's their, you know, aims were unrealistic, or that their aims were morally problematic, or, you know, ethically problematic, or all of that at the same time.
I mean, there are different strands of those at this literature, right? Whether it's from the perspective of, you know, realists, whether it's from perspective of normative thinkers, also in relation to what the US did in Iraq, or what have you, or like, you know, maybe leftist literature in relation to like US imperialism and so on and so forth. However, like from my understanding, this work has been done and it is there, right? But how you can take this kind of insights and turn them into some changes that have some impact on you know, American policymakers, or it can have some like positive impact. Because what often happens when people go, and it also happens from Russian perspective, when you go into this rabbit hole of criticizing the US, the problem is you don't go anywhere from there. Because you just end up in like this strong criticism, whether it's from left or from right, and you just don't end up. You just end up anywhere because like your tone just.
The question is, what do you want to achieve with that? Do you want to achieve that, for instance? And I guess that goes for Russian and American policymakers, not least because the countries are so incredibly large. And I mean, you can basically live your whole life without having to leave the place.
Yeah.
And of course, this self-understanding, I guess, of both foreign policy elites that their country is either the most important one on this planet or at least among the top three, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So I think the problem that comes with that is that you don't have to, or you are usually not confronted with the perceptions of others. I think if you are a Norwegian or a Swiss person, mm-hmm. and especially Swiss foreign policymaker or Norwegian foreign policymaker, you know, you are surrounded by a lot of states that you sort of have to take into consideration when you think about the foreign policy of your country. It's something that is a little bit trickier mm-hmm. with regard to the US and Russia. The other thing is that I think especially American presidents don't know a lot about the world out there. I mean, yeah. We've had those things about that. Apparently, George W. Bush couldn't, see the difference between Slovenia and Slovakia. Mm-hmm. And admittedly, if you look, you know, if you have this idea that, you know, a person from outside looks at those tiny little, you know, countries, from an American perspective in Europe, it may be a little bit difficult, but still you would expect, hey, that's something you should know. Apparently that Barack Obama wasn't terribly well informed about global events. So I think it depends on, you know, your self-understanding as a country, basically also the school system and curricula. Mm-hmm. And then certainly something that I addressed earlier, and that is how you train diplomats. Of course, I mean, if you train a diplomat, that doesn't mean that you train a president. But I mean, at least then the president or the head of state does have the necessary expertise in order to, you know, deal with or get the information that is needed. And there are some places where it, you know, especially since countries such as Russia and the US have the means to have, you know, a diplomatic presence mm-hmm. across the globe. I mean, it should actually be comparatively easy for them to have a well-functioning mm-hmm. diplomatic service. I think they both have it to a certain degree, but I mean, then at the same time, I'm often surprised how little State Department officials don't speak either, like, really fluently a second language, or master other languages as such.
I mean, in the US,
it's quite surprising for me. I think that is not the case. Not that German diplomats are terribly good at that, but I think for most European diplomats, they speak at least three languages. And I mean, mm-hmm. that's something that you cannot expect from American diplomats, I would argue. Or maybe mm-hmm. I just met the wrong ones.
And also, I think it's very important to have a certain... You need to have a competition of ideas, right? If you look at any big security or like a foreign policy problem, you need to have a certain understanding of you're doing things because this idea is really compelling.
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis, because it would basically explain that the US, or it could be one reason why we have the, let's call it just, you know, the US-Russia rivalry. Mm-hmm. Because you know that I love euphemisms. But I mean, because in that sense, in a non-democratic country, and I think we agree that Russia, at least at this point in time, is certainly an undemocratic country, it may be rather difficult to, you know, come up with alternative foreign policy descriptions, unless they come from the, you know, elite mm-hmm. itself. I'd say, in that sense, the environment for that is there in the US as a democratic state. At the same time, mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see that this entire change or new findings, say, of foreign policy analysis, or the findings of people who actually have lived in places abroad and have profound expertise on a certain country, mm-hmm. that this somehow isn't translated into U.S. foreign policy, or at least, you know, it doesn't really end up as a resource for decision makers. And in that sense, also, no matter whether you look at Republican or Democratic foreign policy, of course, you do have organizations and ministries that are in place, and where also you have public servants, so they don't necessarily change. But still, even with all the different people that are part of that revolving door system mm-hmm. that come to, you know, positions of relative power, I would say. It's interesting to see that changes seem to be gradual. And I mean, there don't seem to be any kind of paradigmatic changes in a way. Maybe with regard to some countries.
Yeah.
But I mean, they would rather be smaller countries. But I mean, as such, I wouldn't see incredible differences. I mean, it's a lot about America first, and which primarily seems to be one of security isolationism meeting a kind of trade policy that reduces trade deficits with countries. Maybe that's a way to put it. But I mean, as such, that's not, you know, it may be quite a rupture from the past, but it's not something terribly revolutionary. It's, I mean, mm-hmm. it's a very, say, self-asserted and, you could call it egoistic or even maybe ideological approach, but as such, it won't really change things that much. I would argue with regard to US-China relations, US-Russia relations, there is nothing like new. And even things that were presented as new, like Obama's speech in Cairo, talking about the so-called Arab Spring, eventually didn't materialize in anything substantial. And maybe there really shouldn't be blamed for. But also this entire thing about the restart with Russia, you know, didn't work out. So, I mean, there were a lot of announcements. There was also the speech in Prague on, you know, the reduction of nuclear weapons. And I mean, I think this was, at least from the things I recall, the sort of most revolutionary at this point in time, or like in the last 15 to 20 years. But as such, it's like, it's, I mean, the rhetoric often changes, but I mean, what the policies as such also, I mean, and I think there is also a strong misrepresentation, especially of Trump. So, I mean, in the latest edition of The Economist, there are four different statistics on immigration, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's also something we did in my class on immigration. And it clearly shows that the number of deportations under Obama was higher than under Trump. Now, the media representation is the other way around, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, everything that made it to the news and the kind of way the deportations were actually conducted mm-hmm. by ICE, this agency actually hunting down so-called illegal migrants, was certainly more terrible. But I mean, in that sense, I mean, if you just look at the sheer numbers, I mean, it doesn't show you that sort of Obama was the more humane president or anything like that. I mean, it's also you. I would at least say that there is also a certain media bias in that sense. The same goes, for instance, about, you know, other things where, I mean, the Trump record is at least not as, you know, black and white as some people like to present it. I'm not arguing, as Donald Trump himself does, that, you know, without him there wouldn't have been any wars. And I mean, yes, there was also some kind of historical coincidence and pure luck for him that sort of the world back then, when he was in office, was a little bit calmer. But I mean, as such, I think if you take away the rhetoric, you see that there is a lot of continuity, at least when it comes to the same goes for anything he said on NATO. Because I mean, if you look at what was done under Trump, the Ukraine got even more weapons, and also the American troop presence as such wasn't reduced. It was moved sort of away from Poland and away from Germany and rather eastwards, because I mean there were more troops in Poland than enhanced combat presence started. So I mean,
but
or continued. So you also see that. So I mean, there. So you also see a large discrepancy between the rhetoric of him technically threatening to leaving NATO, and I mean, I know there is now also this entire talk about you know, that NATO wouldn't come to the defense of a country that doesn't spend 2%. So, I mean, I'm not saying that he is actually creating tensions and anger, resentment, and also, you know, also maybe making NATO weaker in that sense. But, I mean, just if you look at what he did in his first term, I think things are a little bit more, you know, or are less clear-cut. And I mean, there are also things that are, I would argue, deeply, you know, not contradictory, but at least very ambivalent. So, I mean, this rhetoric on, you know, basically anti-NATO, but at the same time, what he did not being really anti-NATO. And the same goes for you know, immigration and the figures I just mentioned. This, you can have a look at the same when it comes to the use of drones and drone attacks. I mean, also where way more frequent under Obama than under Trump. So, again, it's tricky, and there is a lot of continuity, and I think in that sense, one shouldn't pay attention that much to the rhetoric. Also, but not, I think it's exaggerated, or it's, I think, also not very helpful in order to see the bigger picture.
That's true, and also, I think, with Western rhetoric, I mean it often definitely contradicts Western actions. But coming back to the point of American presidents, I think there is a lot there in the sense that it's obviously very hard as a president of the US to manage the whole international system on your own. Of course, it's mostly delegated to, so to speak, professionals, right? People who, you know, in State Department or in other, or in Department of Defense, who mostly responsible for, like, again, preserving this continuity, because the US president cannot simply reverse, you know, years and years and years of policymaking. And of course, it's interesting how our discussion turned just to discussing America, because of course there is, I think for the whole world, there is like this big tension of whether there is a continuity in this idea that the U.S. goes global and U.S. should basically be the sole arbiter of the international system or not. Again, this is, again, the interesting thing for the future, right? And for coming decades, whether the U.S. will either stay as the sole, one can say, superpower, or it will gradually do something with, you know, based on the current dynamic, it will gradually decrease its involvement and give path to, you know, other powers to take over, so to speak, or, you know, to work.
Well, I think the question is, can it be forced to step down, if you want to use that metaphor? And I think that's what all the debates about U.S.-China relations are about. So, I mean, it's this the thing that, you know, some historians say this is a typically, this is a, you know, a process that has happened repeatedly in the past. So there are, you can call them superpowers, you can call them great powers, you can call them empires, you can call them whatever you like. But I mean, that their power fades at some point in time, or there is at least some kind of competitor. And I mean, it's pretty clear that the competitor during the Cold War was the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The Soviet Union no longer exists. Russia still is powerful, but I mean, in comparison, less powerful than the Soviet Union back then was. Mm-hmm. And now we see a similar picture emerging with China. So, I mean, one thing is, of course, that there is a certain way how the United States will have to behave in a way. And the other thing is what it sort of also self-consciously decides to do. So I think it's they are not necessarily identical, I would say. So, I mean, there is one way of, I mean, it could just technically accept that, hypothetically speaking, the rise of China will actually mean that if you look at trade volumes or even the size of the military, that it sort of were to grudgingly accept that China becomes a rival, sort of on the same level, or even succeeds, or has more power than the United States. It won't likely do so, because that's what all the, you know, historical literature is about, the rise of starting with Thucydides and what have you. But I mean, as such, I think what is often not analyzed properly is that there are certain constraints and there are certain things that a country cannot do because it, you know, it lacks the resources, and it also depends on at least some degree of legitimacy in the so-called international community. At the same time, there are some decisions where even if it is not in the national interest, it could still take a decision to do something. I mean, the U.S. could technically reduce its number of military bases abroad. I mean, the question is why to do so? Because I mean, it serves its purpose, or it serves it's as such beneficial. So I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, I mean, strategic considerations in that regard that I think have to be taken into. I mean, well, on the balance sheet for.
Mm-hmm. I would actually make a connection between China and NATO, because I think if we talk about more or less a decade of analysis into the future, I think the question of NATO expansion as such will be central to understanding how the US deals, or how the US self-perceives itself and how it deals with the world in the future. And probably I would say Chinese, like, observing closely what is going to happen there. Because of course now is like the biggest issue in, you know, international security, and the biggest issue maybe in foreign policy as well. Because I would say it comes into terms with Russia that, you know, Ukraine won't become part of NATO, then you have certainly one type of America in the future. On the other hand, if you have the US that will strongly push for Ukraine in NATO, with all the consequences that it might bring, you know, potentially European war, then you have another type of the US, so to speak, you know, the one that will probably have to go and fight for Europe again, which again, actually very interesting, because if you think this is the biggest, you know, kind of, I mean, this is the biggest identity problem in the US, probably policymaking community now, because of course, I would strongly argue that no American administration, at least in foreseeable future, will cede this power instrument, like NATO expansion. This is somehow is just central to the whole concept of American identity now. However, if they were to do it, I would say it completely reconceptualizes what America actually stands for in the world. it kind of opens America for maybe, I mean, one can say, you know, becoming more multipolar in a way, understanding that, you know, it's not the sole kind of arbiter, it's not the sole power in the system. So I think this is like a very interesting thing to analyze and to observe. Because we will be, I think, observers of this event. I mean, it's maximum because Russia-Ukraine war cannot last 10 years. I don't think so. 5 years maximum, but it should bring some solution, so to speak. Because unfortunately, war is the ultimate decider in international politics. If you have a war, you need to have a certain solution, especially if you have a war between...
But there can be all kinds of solutions, right? I mean, or at least imaginable. I mean, I mean, the way how you could technically resolve the Ukraine war, there are so many things that, you know, were presented as potential blueprints, so that's tricky. But I mean, there is one thing that I, you know, wanted to pick you up on, but I'm afraid we ran out of time. Maybe we can discuss that next time. And that is that I would be curious to learn whether Chinese diplomats actually use the same kind of reasoning as most Western diplomats do, and that is making use of analogies. I mean, the most cliche one is one that you find in the papers, and that is that, you know, a person that you despise, that you find terrible, you simply call that person a new Hitler. We've seen that with Saddam Hussein, we've seen it with Slobodan Milosevic, with Vladimir Putin. But I mean, as such, if you use less crude versions, such as, you know, this is like the new Munich 1938, or this is the new Sudetenland crisis, or exactly that thing is the way how the Americans and the Russians behave or, you know, act in the Ukraine war, is some kind of template or will tell us something about how the Americans will behave with regard to Taiwan, is of course an analogy. And the question is whether it is not also some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Because of course there are also differences, not least because Russia and China are different countries, but also because the entire history of the four countries, meaning Russia and Ukraine and China and Taiwan, are different. And I mean, also the strategic considerations may be different. Also the ideas of what is it that is actually supposed to be achieved by invading the respective country, assuming that they will, you know, the Chinese will invade Taiwan at some stage. So, I mean, I think as such, analogies can be helpful in order for, you know, some kind of scenario. But I think it's also problematic that they actually or present a kind of framework for analysis and actually take some things for granted that may be less clear-cut if you look at it closer.
I mean, also coming back to identity, I think the whole Western narrative is really obsessed with the idea of the other, as you said. I think this is pretty clear that, and also from my little knowledge of, you know, Chinese foreign policy making and Chinese culture is actually a very self-centered identity. It doesn't look to others. It has everything, like, I mean, all the ingredients and components for its identity in itself. So it's less prone to, you know, looking at others and less prone to, you know, comparing and just creating those type of narratives. While the West, I mean, both Russia actually and the West, it's like the US and, you know, Europe, they're really obsessed with, you know, the whole concept of the other. It has been definitely central to whatever policy making or just, you know, history, like of the recent three, four centuries. And I think it definitely won't dissipate. If anything, it definitely kind of now, this is the whole identity formation. It's definitely there, and it has amplified with the war in Ukraine. Which again, yeah, it's interesting how it's going to play out, and maybe we can discuss the further developments.
The other,
yeah.
Next time.
Next time.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you
very much.